The sign-in sheet still out there? Oh, no hurry if you're using it. Well, you done it? Okay. Thank you. Now, not only is today in general unusual compared to most days, but this first chapter is a little bit unusual. This is a kind of an overview chapter, more or less a catch-all. There's a lot of different topics in it. Most chapters focus on one thing, but this is an introductory overview chapter of biology. And before I get into it too deeply, let me say that you can do whatever is necessary. Do whatever is appropriate for your learning style, of course. But as far as notes are concerned, I think it's a good idea to approach this old style, meaning taking notes on blank pieces of paper instead of in the margins of printout of the slideshow, for instance. And you should definitely think of the notes that you take while I'm speaking as the first draft of your notes. Your notes are what eventually become the final piece of information to study for the exams. But those notes need to be refined. You take down what you can in here, and then you refine it at home, like I said. Well, to do that, you need to know in your notes where you are on the slideshow. So I really recommend that you draw a line in your notes every time I change slides and indicate what slide I'm on, which is always the red number, and I always try to say it in vocally in the recording as well. Well, this is biology, so we might as well talk about life. Biology is the study of life, but that's not a really easy thing to define, actually. It's more of a thing that you, most people can notice if they're confronted with it. Yeah, that's a living thing, rather than to say, what is a living thing? But speaking of living things, that's one of three kinds of things that are in the universe. Living things. What are the other two? Does anyone know? Or anyone want to guess? Any object in the universe is either a living thing, or what other two things?
I'm going to guess, probably a virus?
Well, a virus is an example of one of the other two. But I just mean as a whole category. If a thing is not a living thing, no, all living things are organic, but there's plenty of non-living things that are organic. I just gave away one category, by the way. Non-living is another category. So what's the third? What is something that is not a living thing and not a non-living thing? Logically, it seems that those two would be exclusive, but it's, I mean, they are exclusive, but I mean, it seems like they would be exhaustive. There would be nothing else left, right, between living and non-living. But what is the third category? No guesses? Dead things. Dead things are not non-living things, right? No, they are no longer living, but a dead thing was something that was alive and no longer is. Non-living things weren't alive to begin with. You know, a rock is non-living. A corpse is dead. You are a living thing. Those are the differences. But even though it's easy to say that, what is it actually that makes a living thing living? Well, I hinted at this before. It is the chemistry that occurs in these living things. That's what life actually is. Life is a subset of chemistry. It's the chemistry that happens inside of cells, which is what this whole course is about. But beyond that, you can also recognize, as this slide indicates, that organisms, which is another word for a living thing, share, even though there's all kinds of different organisms, there's a huge variety of organisms in the biosphere, Despite that, all living things share some properties, which are what these seven major things are shown here are. Now, some of these things could be properties of non-living things as well. But I don't know of any non-living things that have all of these properties, whereas living things have all of these. So let's just quickly survey these clockwise, starting with response to the environment. Response to the environment is just what it says it is. Organisms respond in a certain way to their surroundings. I mean, you already know this, right? Just from living your own life. But that's true not just of humans. That's true of structurally the simplest organisms, which are single-celled organisms. You know, unicellular organisms are structurally simple. Multicellular organisms are structurally more complex because they're made out of more than one cell. But this brings up an important point, and you mentioned viruses earlier. Are viruses living things?
Yes.
Everyone agree?
No.
I don't either. A virus is not a living thing. A virus does not have any metabolism. It doesn't have any of the chemistry that goes on that I just said is life, and which goes on inside of cells. Structurally speaking, that is the bare minimum for being an organism. You have to have at least one cell in which those chemical reactions are occurring. That's an organism. Well, a virus isn't even close to a cell. It's tiny compared to a cell. It's just a couple molecules. And it's there's always people who say they are alive, and it makes sense because you're already familiar, especially in the wake of a pandemic, viral pandemic, you already know that viruses obviously interact with organisms, and they cause a lot of things to happen in organisms. But they are not themselves organisms. They just are special molecules that can actually cause things to happen in organisms, in the cells of those organisms. All right. So all living things, all organisms have at least one cell. And they all respond to the environment, even a bacterium, which is a simple, structurally simple organism. Reproduction. Now, this is not a requirement. For instance, I have chosen not to reproduce, but I'm still an organism. It didn't make me a non-living thing. What reproduction here refers to is that as species, there is the ability to reproduce. And this is something you already know also from living your life, right? Organisms reproduce. Now, they are not the only things that do reproduce, by the way. This is, I said earlier, that there could be non-living things that have some of these properties. Reproduction is an example of that. There are, certain crystals can reproduce without being alive, but organisms in general reproduce, or can reproduce at least. Growth and development is shown here on the bottom, lumped into one. It's really two different things, but they're related. Growth, as the word implies, is an increase in size. Well, that's true of all organisms, even a single cell. Now, we are multicellular organisms, and we grow by adding more and more cells to our body. Or that's how you got to be an adult. You started out, all of you started out as a single cell, a zygote. But you're now many, many cells big, so that's part of growth. But even a unicellular organism grows. And this actually brings up a little side topic, which is something important called called cell theory. And cell theory says that cells come only from pre-existing cells. They don't just pop into existence. Now, that's been true for a long time, but obviously it wasn't always true. There had to have been a time when cells did come into existence out of things that weren't cells before. That was, we'll talk about that later, totally different conditions compared to now. But nowadays, and for the last few billion years, cells come only from cells to start with that produce new cells. So anyway, the reason I'm bringing this up on growth of a single cell is that when a bacterium, for instance, is a typical unicellular organism, reproduces, which can be every 20 minutes. The lifespan of a bacterium is about 20 minutes, and then it splits into two new cells. By the way, that's different from how we reproduce, right? Because the parent no longer exists. Now there are two offspring and no parent. But anyway, it should make sense, just common sense-wise, that if one cell splits into two, those two resulting cells, at least at the beginning, are only going to be roughly half as big as the first cell, right? So even cells grow, but multicellular organisms grow by adding cells. And development is a little bit different because it refers to changes along the way. So we, as I said, start out as a zygote. That's one cell. How many cells are in a typical adult human? Have you ever wondered this? Or have you ever looked it up? But of course, it depends on the human. But an average size, normal adult human is roughly somewhere between 10 and 100 trillion cells. That is a hell of a big number, which means that cells are so small that even a billion, which is a big number, a billion cells is not really much of you. You know, a trillion is a thousand billion or a million million. Anyway, we are not simply 100 trillion carbon copies of that zygote that we started out as. By the time you get to be an adult, there are many different kinds of cells in you, right? There are neurons, hepatocytes, all kinds of different cells that specialize for different reasons. They're not all just identical, even though genetically they have the same DNA. So, but anyway, that's part of development. Energy processing is something we'll spend a whole unit to in unit three. That's usually the hardest part for most students. But organisms are continuously processing energy. There has to be a continuous input or throughput of energy for any organisms to remain alive, and we'll talk more about that when we get there. The point is, you can't just be isolated and not make any energy exchanges with your environment and remain alive. You can do that if you're dead, but not alive. Regulation refers to keeping things within tolerable limits. And a huge part of regulation is homeostasis, which is a word that means staying the same. It's kind of a misnomer because it's never true that an organism is ever staying the same. Just like room temperature doesn't stay exactly at what you set the set point at. It's going up and down a little bit all the time, right? But it's not allowed to get too high or too low. Similarly, for all kinds of variables in physiology, which are homeostatically controlled. Homeostasis, if you want a formal definition of it, is maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. If homeostasis fails and you go outside of those tolerable limits, that's one way to die. But keeping things within tolerable limits is what regulation is all about. And there's all kinds of ways organisms achieve this, including behavior, right? Get out of the sun if you're hot, for instance. Okay, order is next. Now this middle of this flower is nice and ordered. That's a good example. It might not seem obvious for some organisms that they're ordered, but even something that doesn't have a nice pattern like this is a very highly ordered structure if it's a living thing. This is another example, by the way, of something for which non-living things have examples as well. Crystals, again. Crystals not only can reproduce, but they are also very highly ordered. Well, even a unicellular organism has a high degree of order when you get down to the microscopic detail of it. And by the way, that order, we'll talk more about this later as well, that order is not free. It's expensive to maintain order. And that feeds back to this energy processing part. But all organisms have a high degree of order. And that leaves the seventh, which is evolutionary adaptation. Now, that's a phrase for which both of these words is important. Let's talk about them individually. Evolution, just linguistically speaking, what, not even having anything to do with biology, but what does evolution refer to in general? It refers to a change, right? To evolve is to change somehow. And evolution is a huge topic within biology, but as far as the courses are concerned, it's more of a Bio 182 topic. You'll spend a lot of time in 182 on evolution. But it's so important we should talk about it a little bit here because we'll need some basics of it later on. Organisms don't evolve. What evolution refers to is evolution of populations of organisms. Meaning from generation to generation, that's where the evolution takes place, between generations, so that the next population is not the same as the previous population in certain respects. So that's in general what evolution refers to. Now, if I say, who is famous for evolution, what is most people going to say? Darwin. Well, Darwin didn't come up with the notion of evolution. There were pre-Darwinian evolutionary theorists. Darwin's not famous for evolution. Darwin is famous for coming up with a hypothesis for how evolution works in biology. And what is that hypothesis? That fact. It's more than a hypothesis now. Oh, I thought you were putting your hand up. What is the mechanism that Darwin came up with to explain how evolution works in biology? Yes, natural selection is how organisms evolve. Well, actually, it's one of three ways that organisms evolve. This is a 182 topic as well. But it's the only one of those three ways in which evolution occurs in such a way that adaptation increases from generation to generation. So that's the other part of the phrase. To adapt means to change in a way that makes for a better fit, right? Like an adapter you plug in. You need DC for the phone. You got AC from the wall. You need an adapter. Well, in evolution, adaptation refers to change in such a way that each succeeding generation in the population gets better fit to the particular surroundings in which that population lives. All right? And the way that happens is because of natural selection. Now, I'll give you some more examples of, I'll give you a better definition of natural selection later, but that's what is referred to by evolutionary adaptation. This is why, by the way, there is such a huge variety of life. All organisms are related. I'm not talking about just the ones that are alive now. All organisms, alive and dead, are related in a one giant family tree that goes back to the last successful first cells. Those cells that we'll talk about a little bit more later that did come out of non-cellular beginnings. They just came out of the chemical makeup of the earth at the time? Well, that probably happened many times, but not, you know, you probably had cells come into existence that were not able to reproduce. Eventually, there was a successful cell that was able to reproduce another cell. And the last time that happened, out of non-cellular beginnings, is the ancestor to all organisms, alive now and long dead. So if you go back far enough, all humans are related. If you go back farther, all humans are related to all other animals, right? We're just one kind of animal. Well, we're also related to all plants. We're related to bacteria. It depends how far back you go. Let me go on to two. Not all of these slides are going to take this long, by the way. Let me go on to two, and now that clock is pretty much worthless. Okay, 20 minutes. In slide two, we are looking at a pictorial representation of what is called the hierarchy of biological organization. Now, a hierarchy in general is some sort of nested arrangement of things. So, you know, a big box can contain smaller boxes within it, each of which contains smaller boxes within it. That's a hierarchy. The hierarchy here has many levels that you can see. And I'm going to take this from small to big. So I'm going to start on the bottom right with atoms. Atoms are not the smallest things, by the way, in the universe. And by things here, I mean material things. We'll talk much more about atoms in subsequent lectures. But atoms are tiny from our point of view. Almost inconceivably tiny objects. There are many, many millions of atoms just in one cell, of which you have 100 trillion in your body. So there are hundreds of trillions of millions of atoms in your body. They are truly tiny, but this is not the lowest level at which you can study things. This is the lowest level at which we care about in biology. Because if you get lower than atoms, then you're really not studying biology anymore. You're studying chemistry and physics, which biology is just a subset of anyway, actually. So atoms is where we'll start. That's one level. And before I forget to say it, let me say that as we go up in levels within this hierarchy of biological organization, we notice that there are what are called emergent properties. Now, to emerge means to come out, to be noticed, right? To stick out. So emergent properties as a phrase refers to the fact that in this biological hierarchy, each higher level has properties that the lower levels don't have. And it's because of the organization. So, for instance, atoms is level the lowest level we'll study. Well, when you get atoms of different kinds together, they make molecules, which are still tiny from our point of view, but they're bigger than atoms. They're made up of multiple atoms. And a molecule has properties that the atoms individually that make it up do not have. That's an emergent property. For instance, you know, you get two hydrogens and an oxygen atom together, you have water, which has properties that neither of the three atoms alone has. That's what I mean by emergent properties. So molecules is the next level. Molecules of different kind organize themselves into more complex structures called organelles, which as a word means a little organ, because they are like organs of your body, only organs within a cell, tiny organs within a cell. So we're still in the subcellular part of this hierarchy. Atoms are smaller than cells, they're subcellular. Molecules are subcellular. Organelles are subcellular. And we'll survey the major organelles that you find in cells, things that you might have studied in high school, like Golgi apparatus and mitochondria and things like that. Those are organelles. All right. Organelles of different types are organized into more complex structures, the next level called cells. And now finally we've gotten to a level in this hierarchy that can feature actual life. Atoms are not alive, neither are molecules. A cell is alive, though. And like I said earlier, a cell is alive because life really is the stuff that's happening inside a cell. And that stuff is chemistry. The thousands of different chemical reactions that are occurring within a cell, which collectively are called metabolism, is life. And cells are like little bags, which more or less are test tubes. You know, a glass test tube in a chemistry laboratory is a little chamber that you can keep separate from the rest of the universe to do specific sorts of chemical reactions in, right? That's what a cell is. A cell has a boundary to it. So there's what's inside the cell, and then there's everything else. And what happens inside the cell can be locked away from the rest of the universe so that that special chemistry can happen, and that's what life is. That's why you have to have at least one cell to be a living thing. Now, another thing I want to say about this level is that there are a couple higher levels we're going to go through that don't exist for all organisms. There are, I've already mentioned, a dichotomy of sorts, a two-part way of thinking. There are unicellular organs and there are multicellular organisms, right? A unicellular organism is an organism, obviously. And a unicellular organism, by definition, has one cell. So it's not, these next few levels will not apply to it. But there are multicellular organisms for which the next levels do apply, and that includes us. We are multicellular. So cells of different types in a multicellular organism get together to form more complex structures called tissues. And the types of tissues depends on the type of organism. For instance, we are animals. More specifically, we're vertebrates. And vertebrates in general have four tissue types. Muscle tissue, epithelial tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue. Other kinds of organisms, like plants, have different kinds of tissues from those categories. But they have tissues. Tissues are collections of cells for a specific purpose. All right? Tissues does not apply to unicellular organisms. Tissues of different type make up even more complex structures called organs. Things like your skin is an organ of the liver, whatever. And a plant, a leaf is a an organ. Yeah.
Would you like kind of like a map of like algae or something as like a tissue but not an organ? Or
part of this is a word game because we try to fit everything into neat little boxes in biology and we always find exceptions. So you could define it as a colony of individual organisms, unicellular organisms. Depends on how they are connected. And actually, this is not an easy thing to solve. There are people that argue about this, for instance. Is the largest organism a sequoia tree, which is clearly an individual? Or is it even bigger mass of fungi that can, you know, that are physically interconnected? Is that all one organism or is that a colony? It gets into kind of an argument about terminology, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you're familiar with your organs. Multicellular organisms have organs. And organs are, an organ is defined as, you know, a collection of tissues that are specialized for a function. But you have multiple different organs, right? And those multiple different organs can be collected together because they are related in their functions, even though they have distinct functions, into what are called organ systems, the next level up. So for humans, there are 11 organ systems. It depends on the type of organism, right? But things like reproductive system, circulatory system, and so on, those are organ systems. And once again, at each of these levels, there's emergent properties. There are things about the digestive system that lower levels don't have. Okay, and then all of the organ systems, however many there are, collected together, make up the individual organism, the next level. Now notice that if you are a bacterium or any other unicellular organism, then organism level and cell level is the same thing. And there aren't these other ones in between. That's what I was meaning earlier. Okay, but an organism is an individual living thing, at least one cell big. Now, that really is the end of where we're going to be in Bio-181 for most of the course, but let's continue on with this stuff that applies to 182, the higher levels. A population, the next level, is a group of organisms of the same species living in a certain area. Okay? Now, if you go up a level from that, it's community. A population, as I just said, is all of the organ, all of the individuals of one species. A community is the same space that they're occupying, but it's all of the species, not just one species. All right, so you can talk about a population of deer, for instance, in an area, but if you include all the plants and other animals and bacteria and everything in that same place, that's the community. Now, how is that different from the next one up, which is ecosystem? Yeah.
I'm going to guess like the physical stuff too, like the water and the temperature and whatnot.
Exactly right. And another word for physical, going back to what I started today with,
non-living.
Would be non-living, exactly. So that's the difference. And a community is all of the living things in a place and dead things. An ecosystem is the community, all the living and dead stuff, plus the non-living stuff in that same place. So the water and the rocks are included. And then the final level is the biosphere, which is all-inclusive. Meaning the biosphere is the set of all known organisms. And it's called a sphere because, for the moment, that's how it's shaped. I say for the moment because it is almost certainly true that there is a hell of a lot of life out there. I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous to think this happened only here with all of the stars out there. So there's probably many, many species out there, but it's just as probable that we'll never encounter any of it because of the huge expanse of space between things and the trouble that, you know, you can only go so fast, right? So until we have definitive proof that there are other organisms somewhere, once we find something, then the biosphere will probably no longer be spherical in shape. But it's a sphere now because the planet is a sphere, and that's the only place we can find life. It's not the whole planet, though. It's a hollow sphere with a thickness to its wall. And the thickness does change all the time because we keep saying, no, there's... We're never going to find any life deeper than that or farther out in the atmosphere than that, but we do keep finding living things well below the surface that we live on. So however deep we can go and still find living things and however far out into the atmosphere and still find living things, that those are the limits of the thickness of the wall of the biosphere. And that's everything. Everything known. Okay. Slide 3. Here we have a photograph that represents an ecosystem. Now, this particular ecosystem is just an example. It's not the point. It could be any ecosystem or just about any ecosystem. But what the important point here, you can see with the arrows, is that for any given ecosystem, or at least surface ecosystem, energy flows through the system, whereas materials, matter, get recycled within the ecosystem. So you can see here that energy in the form of sunlight is entering this ecosystem. Now, as we'll talk much more about later, that energy can be transformed and transferred. It doesn't stay as sunlight once it's in the ecosystem. But, you know, it becomes chemical energy in food that gets transferred from organism to organism, and there's also transfers between non-living things. So all kinds of energy transactions occurring within an ecosystem. But eventually, energy then leaves. Well, you don't see it here. It would be a red arrow coming out of the ecosystem. It leaves as heat. But the main point is that energy isn't contained within the ecosystem permanently. Energy flows through it. Matter, on the other hand, and it's not perfect, it's not perfectly sealed, but matter more or less stays within the ecosystem. And there's all kinds of changes that take place to it. You know, atoms dissociate and reassociate into new molecules all the time, but that's a recycling of materials within the ecosystem. The CO2 and the O2 and the green arrow here is what's supposed to be indicating that. Well, in 4, which is kind of a continuation, you can see once again sunlight coming through. Heat is leaving after several transformations of energy along the way. So there's a throughput. Energy, on the other hand, even though it starts out as sunlight, and that's why without the sun all of this would stop, it doesn't remain as sunlight. But this brings up the importance of our photosynthetic organisms. Not only plants, those are the ones we think of mostly nowadays, but plants didn't invent photosynthesis, bacteria did, well before there were any plants on Earth. Anyway, photosynthesis is a way of capturing that sunlight, capturing the energy in that sunlight, and putting it into materially usable form, meaning chemical energy. And that is a special trick that not all organisms can do. Photosynthetic organisms can do that, though, and that's why we exist. We can't exist without those photosynthetic organisms because we can't make our own food out of sunlight. We are, ecologically speaking, we are examples of consumers. Ecologically, there's also a dichotomy. There's two types of organisms in the world, ecologically speaking, and that is producers and consumers. Producers can make their own food, and they do that not for us, by the way, they do that for themselves. But consumers take advantage of that by either eating the producers, because they can't make their own food, they have to eat a producer, or by eating something that eats a producer, or by eating something that eats a producer, and so on. So all consumers rely on producers. And that's one big part of all of these energy transactions that I was talking about earlier. All right, so remind me that I'm on 5 next time we start, and what are you going to do when you come in next time? Sign in before you sit down. Yeah.